It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and thank you for joining me again this Sunday morning, as you've done for, that's right, a year now. September is, in fact, the one-year anniversary of me being on the air as a talk show host on 1500 Radio. And though the name has changed since I originally came on the air with this talk show, the great guests and the topics are still getting better and better and better. So I want to thank you for tuning in, giving me your feedback, and all of those good things. Today I'm going to do something special on the show because it is a special day. Before I get any of that started, though, I want to say a shout out to a friend of mine, a guy named Jose Espinoza. Now, Jose is a handy guy. He is a great carpenter. But the thing I like about him is he does what he says he's going to do. He does it on time. I just had a good friend of mine who had a contractor walk off the job after not doing anything that he said he was going to do in the time in which he said he was going to do it. That is not Jose. So I just want to say thank you, Jose, for making my basement look great, putting a bathroom in down there, doing all the things you said you were going to do. And if you want to get a hold of Jose, just shoot him a message at joseehandyman@gmail.com. Now, I don't know how far he goes out to do work because he's in Northern Virginia, but let me tell you, when he does it, you'll be very, very happy that he does. This is not a paid advertisement. He's just a good guy. I told him I'd shout him out because I'm appreciative of what he's done for me, and so I'm doing it. All right, Jose, we good? Cool. So listen, I'm asked all the time how I choose the guests for the show, what the motivation is behind getting these guests. So today, I'm going to do a little review of the past year by playing snippets of some of the guests that I've had on that drew the most feedback or had the biggest impact on me personally. I'm going to tell you the motivation behind me getting these guests initially and what I've learned from having them on the show. And also, it's not just the one-year anniversary for me. It's also the one-year anniversary of having the Petty on the show. Now listen, many of you have already probably figured out that the Petty is my brother, 4 years older than I. And you know, as a kid, of course, you know, when you have 4 years between you and your sibling, either they're going to pick on you or you're going to pick on them, depending who's the oldest and who's the biggest. And always as a kid, he was the biggest, so he picked on me. And honestly, he picked on me a lot. And you know, brothers go through their thing. But what I do know, as a kid, I learned everything that I knew about sports, how to play it, the rules, all of that, from him. And even though I grew to be bigger than he is, and probably faster, and stronger, and more athletic, I still didn't know the game the way he knew the games. Like, all of the nuances within the game. I didn't know all of the players the way he knew the players. He did his research on these games because he was making money betting on the games. So when it came to a point where I was going to have a show, and I knew I wanted to do a sports segment, who else would I choose to get my information from except the person who I knew was and is the most knowledgeable about the games that are being played today? So I obviously chose my brother. So he is, in fact, the Petty, and of course, it's his one-year anniversary on the show, too, and this is his heyday. This is his heaven, and he's going to give us the NFL news because the NFL season has started. The games have started. He's going to break down the divisions. He's going to choose some winners for you so you can put some money in your pocket. That's what he does best. But prior to any of that stuff happening, you've got me. I'm going to give you news and commentary because that's how the show started. So I'm going to give you news and commentary from the past week. A few stories that I feel have been the most impactful in this week's news cycle. So I hope you're feeling great because I'm feeling great. I've got a lot to talk about today. So let's get right to it. Fox 45 this week is reporting that the length of probation times for juveniles, along with frustration surrounding juvenile justice laws, remains a concern for some prosecutors and will likely be discussed during a House hearing on the topic scheduled for this coming Wednesday. Rich Gibson, Howard County State's Attorney and President of the State's Attorneys Association of Maryland, said that young people don't always think about their actions and consequences like the way they should. During an interview with Fox 45, Gibson said that some of the laws that we've passed recently make it harder for us to hold juveniles accountable, and that's sort of playing a role in some of the issues that we are seeing today. The Juvenile Justice Reform Act and Juvenile Interrogation Act are two pieces of legislation Gibson said should be reviewed by lawmakers and possibly tweaked. The process to make those changes could begin during the House Judiciary Committee hearing on Wednesday. So, I guess the question for me, personally, is can you protect, rehabilitate, show compassion for a juvenile delinquent, and protect society at the same time? And as a system of government, not as an individual, how do we do that? I mean, remember, within a span of 4 months, you had the same 11-year-old, picked up and arrested 17 different times for car theft. And each time, he was remanded into the custody of his parent. So what do? You can't lock up an 11-year-old and throw away the key. There are no laws in the books that will allow that, nor should there be. But how do you hold that 11-year-old accountable, show compassion to him, rehabilitate him, and at the same time, not scar him for life? Like, how do you do that? And keep the public safe from him stealing their cars again. Now, there seems to be a growing sentiment that parents should be responsible for their kids, the juveniles' actions, monetarily. The problem with that, though, is a lot of these kids come from single-parent homes where the monetary resources are limited to begin with. So where are you pulling that money from? You can't get blood from a stone, right? And if you have someone that's trying to make it, trying to do the best that he or she can as a single parent, how does taking away from that household's money rehabilitate the child? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's something that has to be taken care of because things have gotten way out of control with juvenile crime, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. It just seems to get worse every day. Also in the city, the Archdiocese of Baltimore is considering filing for bankruptcy. The Baltimore Banner is reporting that Maryland Catholics learned earlier this month that the Archdiocese of Baltimore is considering filing for bankruptcy and could make the decision in a matter of days. Archbishop William E. Laurie said in a September 5th letter to parishioners that an expected wave of claims related to sexual abuse allegedly committed by clergy members in the Baltimore area could land as soon as October 1, when a state law ending the statute of limitations for childhood sex abuse claims takes effect. He said that one way to protect survivors and ensure the longevity of the church would be to file for bankruptcy protection. The consideration of the bankruptcy comes about 5 months after the release of a 4-year-long investigative report from the Maryland Attorney General's office detailing hundreds of sexual abuse allegations perpetuated by clergy members within the Archdiocese of Baltimore over the course of 80 years, as well as instances of a cover-up among some of the church's highest-ranking officials. Soon after the AG's report came out, state lawmakers voted in favor of the bill that lifts age limits and time limits for filing civil lawsuits against institutions, including churches and schools, where individuals suffered sexual abuse as a child. That bill also nullifies a legal protection called a statute of repose, which could have insulated institutions from older claims. And that is where the Archdiocese is terrified. They recognize without the protection of the courts and the laws that have protected them from this kind of legal vulnerability before, that there are attorneys like Benjamin Crump, who has already stated that he is like a mythical gargoyle perched on the rooftops in the city of Baltimore, waiting for October 1st to come so that he can swoop down into the halls of the Archdiocese of Baltimore and the Vatican, if need be, to get every penny that these victims deserve. And with the Archdiocese knowing that Benjamin Crump will not be the only attorney coming after them, they're going to make, I'm sure, the decision to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. I mean, it's become a go-to legal defense in the litigation playbook for many entities accused of corporate malfeasance and, in particular, sexual abuse. More than 30 archdioceses and dioceses and at least 3 religious orders have filed for bankruptcy since the early 2000s. And so there's 2 ways that this Chapter 11 works. It doesn't necessarily mean that the church is saying they have no money. What they do is they move to pay out a portion of its owed debt to the claimants, who then become creditors, with a goal of eventually restructuring to become solvent, and then they can continue operating as they always have, which means they don't pay out all the money that they've been sued for. They pay out a portion of it. And those claimants become, you know, like creditors. But they never really get all of the money that they're owed. And the church continues to operate as it always has. The other upside to filing the Chapter 11 for the Archdiocese of Baltimore is that the Archbishop can reorganize the process so that he can divide its gifts and its assets into 2 classes, restricted and unrestricted, to pay out, you know, the potential claims. For example, donors who contribute money specifically for meals, immigration, outreach, or tuition assistance, they wouldn't have their money touched. Their donations would go exactly to where they're supposed to go. They would not be rerouted. But unrestricted gifts and assets, things like money that people put in the plate on Sunday, that money is left to the Archdiocese to do whatever they want. So instead of having to pull from the Catholic Church's incredible wealth, this money comes from the parishioners. So the parishioners are paying the debt to victims who were at one time parishioners. So where is the contrition? Listen, I could go on and on and on about this. I have such deep feelings about this and such anger about this whole situation and how it's been handled, but I'm not going to do that. It's my one-year anniversary show. I'm not going to get all wound up in a ball about the Catholic Church because I just don't want to do that. I've done it before. But I encourage you, if you have not read the AG's report at this point, please, it's public record. It's something that you need to know. I've done two shows on this already. You have to read the report. I mean, you have to. I mean, once you read it, it'll be very difficult for you not to want to get involved. All right, something else caught my eye, caught my attention in Baltimore this week. Last year in August, a nine-year-old, and you'll remember this, a nine-year-old shot and killed a 15-year-old young lady. Nikayla Strada was shot in the head by a nine-year-old who was actually looking for her younger brother. I guess in his anger, he was going to shoot and kill her younger brother, but she would not allow her younger brother to come out of the house. So in his anger, the nine-year-old aimed the gun at Nikayla Strada and shot and killed her. Well, because the laws in Maryland don't allow a nine-year-old to be charged with a crime, the grandmother, the person that the gun belonged to, was actually charged and was sentenced to 4 years in prison for reckless endangerment and firearm access by a minor. The grandmother's name is April Gaskins. She is 55 years old, and she told investigators that the handgun was her personal weapon, and she stored it on the floor of her bedroom closet. Gaskins has no prior incidents with the law, no prior interactions with the police department, no convictions, absolutely no record at all when it comes to crime in the city of Baltimore or anywhere else for that matter. So the question that I have for you is, the nine-year-old shot and killed this young lady. There are no laws on the books that allow a nine-year-old to be charged criminally. So the grandmother, who stored her weapon in her closet on the floor, which, granted, is not the smartest thing to do or the safest thing to do, obviously, but do you think that she should be held responsible for the crime? Meaning, do you think that she should have been sentenced to any criminal time at all? That's the question that I'm asking. She has no record. She's never been in trouble with the law. But now at 55, she's having to go to prison for 4 years. And has a criminal record, and it's a felonious one, meaning she'll be a felon for the rest of her life. Do you believe that the punishment fits the crime here? I'm very curious as to what you think and how you feel about this. So get at me on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. Let me know what your thoughts are. I'm incredibly curious to know how you feel about this. I have my own thoughts about it, but I'm not even going to say anything about it. I just want to know how you feel. So remember, Instagram at On with Brian Pettaway. And one of the biggest stories nationally is the United Auto Workers Union is on strike against General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. The first time in its history that it has struck all three of America's unionized automakers at the same time. The UAW referred to its targeted strike of three plants as a stand-up strike, which it called a strategic new approach to walking off of the job. The union went on strike despite offers from the companies to raise hourly wages as much as 20% over the life of the contracts, with a top existing hourly pay of $32.32. Those offers would have taken the senior most auto workers to a base pay of about $80,000 a year, not including overtime or profit sharing bonuses. But the union started its negotiations demanding an immediate 20% raise and four additional raises of 5% each during the life of the contract. It did lower those pay demands late in the negotiations, though apparently not enough to close the gap to the automakers. But beyond issues of pay and benefits, among the biggest issues underlying the talks is the union's concerns about job losses and plant closings. By the union's count, the three automakers have closed 65 plants so far this century due to a combination of automation, outsourcing, and of course the loss of market share to non-union automakers. And now, the union is concerned that the automakers' plans to invest tens of billions of dollars each to convert from traditional gas-powered cars to a lineup of all electric vehicles will cost them more jobs in the future, because it takes fewer hours of labor to assemble EVs than gas-powered cars, due to the EVs having fewer moving parts. The automakers are racing to build a slew of plants to assemble massive EV batteries that will power the new cars, but they are planning on paying significantly lower wages than the wages paid to the UAW workers at engine and transmission plants, and that shift is a risk to UAW workers. Also on the national scene, sadly, gun violence is threatening to dim Friday night lights and endangering a beloved national pastime, high school football games. This season alone, there have already been at least 16 shootings, resulting in 2 deaths and 13 people wounded at games across the country, according to the K-12 school shooting database, which has been tracking this data since the school shooting in Parkland, Florida in 2018. There have been 2 additional incidents at a high school football field this season, one where a crowd began a stampede after someone flashed a gun, and one where gunfire ended a Pop Warner game. David Reedman, a criminologist and founder of the database, said that he would call it an alarming trend. He said that right now it appears we're on pace with last year, when there was at least one shooting at a football game each week of the season. Last year, two Texas teenagers in a Dallas suburb who had allegedly been plotting to carry out a mass shooting at an Everman High School football game were intercepted by police before they got to the school. Police found an AR pistol and 60 rounds of ammunition in their car. In the upstate New York City of Utica, the public school district this month announced on its official Facebook page that it was beefing up security by only allowing students accompanied by a parent to attend school-sponsored sporting events. The school district made this move after a security officer was shot in the head and wounded last week while trying to break up a fight that broke out in a parking lot outside of a Proctor High School football game. A 16-year-old who does not attend Proctor High School has been charged with attempted murder, criminal possession of a weapon, and a multitude of other charges. Now, of course, Baltimore is not immune to this problem. The very first day of this month, the very first day of September, at a high school football game at Dunbar High School, a 12-year-old was shot right outside the stadium. Now, Brandon Scott, the mayor, is saying that this was not associated with the football game. It wasn't associated with anybody playing in the football game, but it was done right outside of the football stadium. And those persons that were in the stadium, both sides, the home team and the guest team, when hearing those shots, ran for their lives. If you saw the footage, you would think that it was someone in the stadium shooting. I mean, it's just a sad state of affairs today. It doesn't matter where you go, you just don't feel safe. You know, it's just better to stay home. And it's unfortunate because you want to be able to support your kids. You want to be able to support your school, your neighborhood, whatever. But it just doesn't seem safe anywhere you go. But I really, really hope that the Board of Education can work with local law enforcement to come up with a solution for security for these games, because it's incredibly important for the kids that are playing in the games, and it's so much fun for students, faculty, and parents to watch these kids play these games. It's just an important part of our culture, and I hope the violence doesn't overtake it and shut the games down. And finally, today in history, on September 17th, 1787, members of the Constitutional Convention signed the final draft of the Constitution. 2 days earlier, when a final vote was called, Edmund Randolph called for another convention to carefully review the Constitution as it stood. The motion, supported by George Mason and Elbridge Gerry, was voted down, and the Constitution was adopted. All right, don't go away, because when I come back, I'm going to have highlights from shows, from interviews that I felt impacted me, certainly impacted you, because I got a lot of feedback from you folks from these shows. Give you a little history as to why I chose these guests and what they meant to me once I heard the interview and what I learned from them. And of course, I'll have the petty with me, so don't go away. I'll be right back.
Sean E. Merriman presents An Evening with Kiki Wyatt. Kiki Wyatt. We'll be loving to the break of the day. With her special guest, Keith Washington. And the sultry Miss Crystal F. Saturday, September 23rd, 6 p.m. at the James Weldon Auditorium at Coppin State University. Get your tickets at SeanEMerriman.com. This is a Ticketmaster event.
All right, welcome back to Let's Talk. And like I said, it has been 1 year. Last year, September, I started this journey. And there's no way I could have completed this ride without you. So thank you so much for tuning in every Sunday and encouraging me and being a part of this journey with me. But in addition to September being the 1 year anniversary of my show, it's also Suicide Prevention Month. And I mention that for two reasons. A, because I think it's incredibly important that we always check on our friends and our loved ones to make sure that they're okay. Not just the ones that are kind of down, the ones who kind of mope around, but the ones who are up, the ones who always seem to have the answers, the ones who are always well put together. Check on those guys too, the perfectionists. Make sure that they're okay. The strong ones, the ones that always have the answers, always are looking to help out other people. Well, who are the ones that are looking out for them? So make sure you check on these people. And the other reason I bring it up is because this time last year, my very first guest, my very first interview on the show, was a young lady named Kim Cottrell. And at that time, she shared with me how she lost her daughter to suicide, and that her daughter was going through serious battles with depression while in college. And because of the HIPAA laws that allow students to see psychiatrists and get medication without having to inform the parents, her parents never knew how severe their daughter's depression was until their daughter was dead. Here's a snippet of that very difficult conversation.
Especially when your child is not has not had those kind of issues in the first place.
Right.
Now, some people may send their kids off to school and they're already aware that their child is taking medication or, you know, that's a whole different thing. You have a little bit better, idea of what could happen. But when you have a perfectly, what you consider a perfectly normal, healthy child that's got the world by the tail and doing their thing, you definitely don't expect something like that to come up. Like, I wish I could have told my daughter, take a break. You know, it's not the end of the world if you don't complete your college degree in a specific time frame. Mm-hmm. A lot of people go to college, they get, you know, it's hard, you know, just kind of be open with her and let her know that you recognize how hard it can be and how challenging it can be. And sometimes taking a step back from things that are challenging sometimes is the best way, and then revisit it again.
She went on to say a lot of other things that resonated with me, that have stayed with me. But, you know, she didn't have to come on the show, and she didn't have to tell that heart-wrenching story about the loss of her baby girl. But she did, because she wants people to be aware of what's going on with kids. She wants them to know it's not just the unpopular kids or the quote-unquote trouble kids that you have to pay attention to. It's also the ones who strive for perfection and who put enormous amounts of pressure on themselves to be perfect. Now, that was a cautionary tale for somebody like me who has a teenage daughter that does put a lot of pressure on herself to be perfect in school. And true story, the very next day after the show, I drove to my daughter's school while she was in school. I pulled her out of class, and I just gave her a big hug, and I told her, I looked her straight in the face, and I said, hey, listen, I know you don't know why I'm here, but I just want to tell you that I love you. I love you no matter what. I love everything about you, everything that you are, and all I want you to do is be your best. And that doesn't mean that you have to be perfect. I told her, I said, enjoy school, have fun, and most of all, don't be afraid to make mistakes. I said, I've made so many mistakes in my life, I'm still here, and I'm still okay. So I hugged her again. I touched her hair. I don't know what it is about a parent and their child's hair, but it made me feel close to her. I touched her hair, and I just told her that I loved her, and then I let her go back in class. Now, I got in my car. I thank God. I thank Kim Cattrall for inspiring me to have that moment, but it was something that I needed, and I felt much better once I did it. And honestly, because of that show, I speak differently to my daughter. We have different kinds of conversations than we did prior to this interview, prior to this show. So thank you, Kim Cattrall, for coming on, being straight, being honest, being transparent, because it certainly has helped me, and I can imagine that it's helped other parents that listen to the show. So this next highlight that I want to play of an interview was from a show called Inequality in the Black Church, and it was an interview with Reverend Dr. Lori Hairston, who was telling us her story, where she was pretty much ousted from the church where she had played the role of the senior pastor for quite some time, because the senior pastor that had been there had retired or had taken ill, some sense of that effect. And when it came time for her to be voted in, although she was fulfilling all of the duties of the senior pastor and had been for some time, because she was a woman, the board members and some of the parishioners, the female parishioners in particular, felt that she was unfit to lead them in a official capacity as senior pastor of the church. Crazy to me. It got so bad, in fact, that it became violent. They started vandalizing her car, and she literally had to hire her own security to be in the church to ensure her safety when she was there. Now, eventually, you know, the church settled with her because she sued them rightfully, and they settled. But it's a crazy story. Here's a snippet of that.
And that gets to your issue of equity, and I'm going to throw equality into the mix with that. And we're talking primarily here, we're talking about the Black church.
Right.
We love good preaching.
Yes.
And we will forgive a lot of things. We have a hard time forgiving bad preaching. So the preaching part was no issue for me. That was something that I excelled in. That was something that I got a lot of support for. People don't mind you giving them a good word. People don't mind you telling them something wonderful about God to help them get from Sunday to Monday and to make it through the week. It's quite another thing when you are putting yourself in a position to possibly lead them. I had both men and women, Brian, who had no interest in having a female lead them. And some of the worst ones were women.
Why do you think that is?
You know, if that is a very good question. I think that that would be a whole nother show about how it is that we treat each other as black women, mm-hmm. the things that we will accept, the things that we will permit. But let me just say this as a little caveat to that. Some of the women that came for me, so to speak, did so with a vengeance. I mean, with comments like, I just don't want to see a woman in the pulpit every Sunday.
Wow.
Okay. You know, and that's hard to hear, but, you know, for some people, it's just their reality.
And the interview went on, and it told some of the crazy things that happened to her while she was at the church, and eventually she had to leave, and, you know, again, they settled because she sued and all of this stuff. And it's an amazing story. But what was not lost on me is the irony that in the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, the black church was one of the places where we got to talk freely about civil rights and equal rights that we wanted, that we were going to fight for, that we were going to die for in the black church. This is where it took place, in the black church. And it's just crazy to me that after all of these years, that women in the black church are still not treated equally. It's an amazing thing to me. It's an incredibly ironic, sad irony, actually, in the church. You know, I've been blessed, lucky, fortunate, whatever you want to call it, to have had friends that are still my friends from when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. And I also have friends from all walks of life, all races, colors, creeds, cultures, ethnicities. But my core friends are the ones that grew up with me from the time I was a child that are still around. And one of those friends I had on my show because he lived a life that I was completely unaware of. I had a hint of it on occasion, but I was not aware of how bad it actually was. And he was somebody that I've known since I was 6 years old, right? And he told me a story of how close I came to losing him as a friend. And it really hit me hard when he was telling me. I was blown away, but at the end of the day, I'm incredibly proud of him because he's done such an amazing job of coming back from literally almost the dead. So I want to talk to you about my boy, Rayfield Mason Chip. He was on the show, and he gave us a very candid talk about his drug addiction, a very candid talk about his drug addiction, and here's a snippet of that.
Well, I appreciate you giving it and being so honest. I always wondered, man, like, because, you know, I hear about, even my last guest last week, she was talking about how her son went with withdrawals and shaking and fever and sweating and pain and cramping. And she said that her son described it as dying, like he felt like he was dying.
Yep.
And so I wondered, you know, you never described that. You never talked about that pain with me. You talked about a lot of other things, but you never talked about that kind of pain. And if you...
Let me tell you this.
Okay.
No, go ahead. Let me tell you this, bro. That pain that she's talking about, you ain't got to do that for one time. Anybody who's listening, if you're contemplating recovery, one time. That pain, you ain't got to go do that for one time. You have a choice to never, ever go back. My thing, when I used drugs at the early in my active addiction, it was fun. Early, I'm talking about the first year or two.
Right.
It was fun. I had what I wanted. I had my drug of choice. Did, you know, what I wanted to, basically, you know, stayed away from the law. Everybody wanted to rob me, I found out later on in life, but stayed away from the stick-up boys. But later, towards the end, and I say towards the end means the last 27 years of active addiction, I didn't get high for fun. I got high for the sole purpose to die. You understand me?
What?
I got high because I wanted to, I couldn't put a gun in my head and drop the hammer. I used to think people that committed suicide were some of the strongest people on this planet. This is how the disease told me this. If you can take your own life, oh, you big. I got high because I wanted to take one big glass, bro, and just go to sleep and never wake up again. That's what I am. I thought that's what I wanted. I'll tell you a quick story. I had surgery on my foot. This was in 2014, I think it was, at the VA. Now, they have a pre-op where they go over certain questions. Some of these questions are about your addiction. Of course, my questions, but no. Here we are on a gurney. They already give me the drugs. They give you to bring you down a little bit, and they're about to take me into the operating room when they give you the anesthesia or whatever else they give you. Brian, my mom said, you know what? I don't open my mouth, man. I can go in this operating room and let them put me to sleep, and I can never wake up. This is the disease talking to me now. Remember that. I can go in this operating room, they put, give me the anesthesia, and I can go out. I can die right there on the table.
Wow.
And my family, this is the disease, will be able to get some money from my body.
Wow.
Because they have a suitcase. We were going down the hall, and I had my mind made up. This is what I'm going to do. One guy was pushing me. Put me in the operating room. It was so bright in the room. Walls were bright. The lights were bright, white. I looked around, Brian. I said, my man, come here for me. I said, we got to go back over those questions y'all asked me earlier. He said, what do you mean? I said, I mean what I just said. We need to go back into the other room you just took me out of so we can go over those questions again. Push me back down the hall, about 8 docs standing around my bed with clipboards. Saying, you said you didn't use. I said, I know what I told you, man. I just smoked some coke before I came in here.
Wow.
Okay? And yeah, they ended up sending me home.
So yeah, I mean, that's real. I mean, that was my boy. Like, I grew up with him. And, you know, when he was going through what he was going through, you know, I was in the military. I was traveling the world doing my thing, and I would come back to my grandparents' house from time to time and see my boys, see my family. And, you know, I saw Chip one time the entire time I was coming back home, and he was kind of avoiding me. He tells that story in this interview, why he was avoiding me. And I didn't really want to believe what I was hearing. You know, I'm on the street, I'm hearing, you know, Chip's on that shit. I'm like, no, he's not. And they're like, yeah, he is. I just didn't want to believe it. So when I hear this story from his mouth, when I hear from the horse's mouth that he was really trying to die, it hurt my heart. You know what I mean? Because I feel like I should have been a better friend, like I should have known. But you don't always know, and that's the point. That's why I say check on your people, because you don't always know. Life, you get caught up in life, and you don't understand that the life is spinning around you just like it's spinning for you. You know what I'm saying? So check on your friends, check on your family, because you don't know who's going through what they're going through. Just make a phone call, knock on a door, say, hey, how you doing? And really mean it when you ask them. Have time to listen to them when they tell you things aren't going right. You know what I'm saying? I didn't have that. But on the flip side of that, you know, when I talk about a comeback game, his comeback game has been so incredibly strong. I've never seen, well, besides, you know, somebody else that's very important in my life, I've never seen his comeback game so strong. He is doing such amazing things. The boy is always on vacation. I don't know how he does it. He and his wife, he's married an incredibly beautiful woman, and they just do amazing things together. So I'm so happy for him. He found God, and he's just doing amazing things. So that's the good part of that story. All right. So listen, last summer I was at the radio station, and the radio station just happens to be around the corner from a wig and hair shop. I'm sitting in my truck waiting for someone else to come out of the radio station, and I'm watching all of these women on this Saturday go into this wig and hair shop, and they're pulling up in these nice, very nice vehicles. They have these very nice bags. They have very nice nails. They're coming out of the wig shops with very nice hair. However, their bodies don't look like any time has been spent on their bodies. Like, their nutrition and their health just didn't seem to be keeping up with the other things that they had priorities on. And I made the mistake of saying, you know what, Brian, you have a radio show and you say you talk about anything, you're going to talk about that. Well, once I came up with that idea that sounded great at the time, when it came time to air the show, I got very nervous. I'm like, I'm going to be browbeaten about this, right? So I had to find somebody to help bail me out of this, because I didn't know how to get out of it once I announced I was going to have the show. So I called a friend of mine who was double board certified. She is a health and wellness specialist, a guru. She travels the world. She's written books. Her name is Dr. Yolanda Raglan, and she came on the show. She bailed me out, and she told me, yes, this is a true thing. It's a real thing, and she had this to say.
No, those are separate things. So it's very easy for men often to see their health, themselves separately, right? Like, I got to take care of my health, I got to take care of my family, and I have to take care of my job and my business. But those are separate things. Women tend not to do that. And so the mind shift is about really understanding that you're a separate person. It's very difficult to recognize that because of that whole, you know, like I said, the umbilical cord, the placenta. We feel connected to everything, and we're very, you know, and we're not over emotional. I'm not saying that, but we're very intuitive and all these things, but we have to start recognizing where self ends and where self begins, and where our obligation to ourselves is as important, if not more important, than our obligations to our families and to our businesses and to our communities. I use the metaphor all the time of getting on a plane, and the pilot says, look, if something happens and oxygen masks go down, put yours on first and then put others on. And our natural idea as women would be to take care of everybody while we're trying to get oxygen on our own. But, you know, let's make sure everyone else is taken care of. And the answer is no. You cannot help everybody else if you don't help yourself. So right now the shift is self-care, understanding that if you are not well, if you fall ill tomorrow, no one's going to be able to take care of your family the way you do anyway. So you need to step back and decide what's the most important. Another thing that's really that I've decided was very important to me a long time ago, I think I was in my 30s when I decided this, was that for my daughters to see themselves as important and to understand their value, they needed to see a mom who modeled self-care, who modeled and prioritize exercise, who model and prioritize nutrition, so that they realize how important it was for them. So it wasn't about me prioritizing their nutrition only. I was very clear that there are things that I might buy that they could eat because they were young. But if I bought certain things that were foods for me, I was very clear about that. Look, this is mommy's and this is yours.
I got to say, once I heard her say the things that she said, I felt much better about actually having the show, because it was a very informative and educational show, not just for me, but for everybody. I mean, I learned so much, and so did other people. I got a lot of feedback on it. I ran it twice, actually, because she threw out so many tidbits of information and so many great nuggets that we can grab onto and exercise in our lives daily that aren't hard. So it was a great interview. I'm so glad I got her to come on the show. And I'm glad I was able to muster up the courage to have the show because it turned out to be very, very good. The next guest that I had on that I felt had a bit of an impact on me based on what he said, and I got a lot of feedback on as well, was the Reverend Dr. Jamal Bryant. And I asked him about the controversies in his life, how he dealt with them. Being a person in the spotlight. We talked about a lot of things. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I didn't want to do a hit job on him because, you know, there's been a lot of things written about him. I just wanted to know how he handled those things and kept pushing through. And this is what he said.
Now, there are successful people, Jamal, in the spotlight. You know, they're never criticized about their successes. But some like yourself, you know, you've seen your share of criticism. How do you handle the controversial comments that come to you? Like, how do you handle that and just keep moving on?
Yeah, you have to understand that the average pastor of a mega church is 63.
Okay.
And so they are beyond the grasp of social media consumption. I have been in the public spotlight since I was 27. So all of the ebbs and flows of my life are public fodder, where most people who are in my position emerged before people had an Instagram account.
Got you. And they had already lived that life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So the realm of people that I could call that would identify with that struggle would be very slim.
Hey, that's a good point. You know, you wrote a book, I think it was in 2010. It's called World War Me and How to Win the War I Lost. Yep. In that book, you had a passage, a message, and you said that one of your mentors, you didn't name him, but you said that he told you the only thing that you have in life are two things, and it's your image and your integrity. And you said that you digested one and discarded the other. I think that's what you said.
Yes. No, you got it.
Okay, so
that was Bishop Ingram, who was a retired AME bishop, said that to me. And I used a lot of my currency around fortifying image without developing integrity. John Maxwell wrote a book called Talent Is Not Enough.
Right.
And it really talks about how people, particularly in church, fawn over the talented without investing in their character. You know, the old adage is people who say money won't change them never had any. So if you, you know, like 30 years old driving a Bentley, it is you know, the same as you just giving a basketball player money. Who had the grounding or the internal fortitude to be able to handle that.
Right, right. So when you were living that lifestyle and you saw the criticism, is that something that helped shape your character, I guess? So did it help straighten you out? Did you feel that?
It was a wake-up call because sometimes in crisis is when you discover your value.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's easy for, I don't know, somebody who knew you in college, somebody who used to work with you, somebody who lived three doors down to say, hey, I got an issue with this guy.
Right.
It's altogether different for somebody to say they hate you and they've never met you.
Never met you.
That interview with Reverend Dr. Bryant was kind of interesting for me because I've known of Jamal and had been in the same circles. We traveled in the same circles and knew some of the same people, know some of the same people, with small degrees of separation throughout Baltimore for a very, very, very long time. So, you know, on one hand, I know Jamal to be this guy who was flashy and flamboyant, boastful, braggadocious, manipulative. And then on the other hand, I know him to be a great inspirer, a great orator, a great influencer, a man who did amazing things for people. It was almost diabolical. But to hear him say out of his mouth that there was a time in his life when he put image in front of character, made me understand that no matter what the age, maturity can hit you. And when it hits you, it changes you. Because I've seen what he does now in Atlanta that he wasn't doing when he was in Baltimore. And it's a very refreshing thing. So I was glad to speak with him, to hear the things that he said. And hopefully he's walking that walk now. It appears that he is. I think one of the most fun and one of the most controversial and surprising interviews that I had was with a Miss Arise Wanzer. She's an actress to model out in Cali and a transgender woman. And I had so much fun interviewing her because she really didn't care. Like, I didn't agree with most of the things that she said. I listened. I heard her. Again, it wasn't to do a hit job. It was just basically to see how she thinks. And it was so much fun to hear her just go. And apparently it was fun for you guys, too, because I got a lot of feedback on her as well. And this was a snippet of that interview.
That's me personally. I know it's personal, but I'm older. I don't cherry pick every single thing to be offended by, but I genuinely don't care. Like, it's like, oh, I said she, or I said he instead of she. I'm like, whatever, girl, just give me my coffee. I don't care.
Right. But that's you. You know what I'm saying? It seems like you have
It's personal.
Right.
It's personal. But my thing is, when you're easily offended by something, I think that you're wrestling with something that you haven't sorted out within yourself.
There you go. There you go.
And well, so,
you
said it, so I didn't have to. I've sorted out who I am with myself. So if someone misgenders me, I don't give a shit. I know who I am. You're not going to tell me who I am. I know who I am better than you do.
Right.
So if someone gets misgendered and they might get upset about it, even if it's like, especially when it's a mistake. If it's a mistake and then they're going to get so upset about it, it's like, well, I think you've got some other stuff to wrestle out with yourself, babe.
Right.
Because you shouldn't be so upset. Like, because it happens to anybody. It could happen to anybody.
So let me ask you, you said that you came out, not came out, but you decided to be who you are without fear around 17. Is coming out the proper term? Did you just decide?
You could say coming out. I would start saying like living as a woman. You could say that. Okay. Like I'm living like open, loud and proud as a woman. Like I'm doing this. Like right. I'm done. So it was about 18 because I got to Miami, but I was 18 when I got there.
When you did that, How did what was that like psychologically for you? How were you accepted, and how did you find navigating the world differently at that point?
Well, I always make the joke because I went to college in Miami. I always tell people I hit the tarmac and I just started telling the truth. Like I told everybody, I was like, you know what? I'm a woman and I'm not doing that shit anymore. I'm not pretending I'm someone else for these fucking Virginia hick people. I said it. I don't care. No, because it was just backwards thinking ass conservative people. Like, you don't like black people, you don't like fat people, you don't like queer people. I mean, you don't like nothing.
So you have like, Arise, tell us how you really feel, right? Don't hold anything back. And she didn't hold anything back. But it was a great and fun interview. She let us into her mind and a way of thinking of a transgender woman. I don't particularly agree with a lot of it. I still believe that it's psychological, that it's a psychological issue or an imbalance, and I told her so. But at the end of the day, she's happy with who she is. She's incredibly honest, incredibly likable, has charisma for days and personality, and I just enjoy talking to her. So I'm so thankful and I'm so glad that she came on the show. So the last, you know, snippet I want to play of an interview that I want to highlight is of the governor, Governor Wes Moore. And it has nothing to do with education. It has nothing to do with politics really at all. It has everything to do with him being a black man, the very first black governor elected in the state of Maryland, and how that feels for him. And I made a comment about how I feel in Annapolis, and I wanted to know if he felt the same way. And so I asked him this question, and this is what I got.
One last thing. When I walk in around Annapolis, in particular around the dock, I feel a certain way. I feel the history, like it's not lost on me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I feel like, I almost feel like my ancestors are looking at me, and I can see what they saw when they stepped off the boat. Tell me about your march from the docks of Annapolis to your inauguration. What inspired that?
Well, you know, I one thing I think people realize about me is I move with intentionality. We don't try to do anything by accident, because I don't think anything is an accident. Right. And when I thought about what was the message that we wanted to send on that morning, where I was about to be inaugurated as not just the 63rd governor of the state of Maryland, but the first African-American governor in our state's history, only the third who's been elected in this country's history. And I knew I wanted to start down there, because I knew that the history of our journey was important.
Right.
And something we should never lose sight on. So started down at the Annapolis docks, which is one of the oldest slave ports in our country's history.
Correct.
And as you said, you know, then marched with a couple hundred folks, marched from the docks up to the State House where I was sworn in. And by the way, the State House was built by the hands of enslaved people.
Yes.
And it was interesting, because when people said, well, he's starting the first minutes of his administration, he's starting with indoctrination. I'm like, that's not indoctrination. It's history.
So obviously, you know, with 40 plus shows, I couldn't play highlights from all of them. Just didn't have the time today. But so many of the shows had an impact on me, and I just wanted to highlight a few of them. I was very concerned about the interview with the governor, because I interviewed him as a gubernatorial candidate. And he was very nice and forthcoming and honest and gave me his time and was generous. And I didn't know if he would be the same person as the governor. You know, once you're elected, you don't have to be anything other than the elected governor. At that point, you're already in the seat. But he was the same guy. And I was very, very impressed with that. So, you know, he's unapologetically black, but he knows that he's the governor of everyone in the state. And for that reason, I know that the state is in good hands. But listen, I know that you hear the music. It is the 1-year anniversary for the Petty as well. So let's get him on the line and see what he's talking about today.
Good morning, Brother B. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Petty. Good morning to you. Happy anniversary, sir.
Oh, man, a big happy anniversary to you. Oh, my goodness. 1 whole year. And this has been a ride. It has been fantastic. I am so happy for you, brother.
Nah, man, I'm happy for us, man. I mean, you come on the show, you knocked it out of the box, man. I'm so happy that you've been with me on this ride. It's everything. It's everything.
It's been an incredible ride, and I've been happy to just go along for the ride. It's been fun. It's been great. And, man, I just hope this train just keeps right on moving.
Right? Me too. Me too. Me too. What you got for me this week, man? A lot's been happening. A lot's been happening.
Well, a lot's going to happen. And let me tell you something. Last week, oh, boy, did they start the season off right with that Kansas City Lions game.
Right.
And you know what I've been saying all along about that team out of Detroit? I call them the pesky Lions for a reason. You saw what they did on the big stage the first game of the season. And I think they are a team that's going to need to be reckoned with when it's all said and done.
Well, you know, Mike Tirico said it was an asterisk game for the Kansas City Chiefs because Kelce wasn't in there. So what you think?
Man, look. I always say this, brother, be next man up. So I don't want to hear no excuses about, well, because Travis Kelce didn't play and all that other stuff. That's why they got 53 men on the team.
Right.
Next man up.
Right.
So, no, a win is a win. If they would have won, they wouldn't have been saying, they've been saying, oh, they know how to win without Travis Kelce. So if they can win without him, they can lose without him. It goes both ways. So I'm not trying to hear that.
Right.
But let me tell you something, man. It was just so many things that went on last week and so many upsets. And I looked at so many teams, and I'm telling you right now, that team from the NFC that everybody's saying is going back to the Super Bowl, they looked awfully shaky on Sunday. And you know what? They just seemed like they barely pulled it out Thursday night.
I wondered how you felt about that, man, because, you know, you're in that area. So I wondered how you felt about it.
I'm not impressed with what I've seen from that team right now. They have a lot of talent, and I just don't know what to be. I don't see them going back to the Super Bowl. I don't even see them making it to the NFC Championship next year.
Which is weird, man. It's weird because they had so many upgrades. They had so many upgrades, and it's just weird that they're not doing better.
I have a theory about that, and I'm going to talk about that a little later, about the upgrades and that some of the changes a lot of teams made that should have made them better. Speaking of one team, I'm talking about those Jets, and oh my goodness, you got to feel for them.
I don't feel for them at all because I'm not an Aaron Rodgers fan.
Series. And, well, I was looking for them to be a better team, and then they're just right back to where they were.
Right.
Aaron Rodgers done. Four plays, done for the season. Torn Achilles, and at his age, he said he's coming back. He said he's not going out like that, but he will be coming back.
What do you think of Zach Wilson?
Zach Wilson, he's a bum. That's why Jets are calling around looking for another quarterback. I mean, Zach Wilson was probably the happiest guy on that field Sunday night when they ran that punt back to win the game.
Yeah,
because he figured, I'm not going to have to go back out there and try to win this game for us. I just don't think it's in him. We'll see how it plays out for the rest of the season. They have a good offense. They have a very good defense. We'll see how everything plays out for the Jets.
Okay.
And there are two teams that look like, man, they're going to be juggernauts this year. I'm talking about them boys who you know I despise.
I hate them.
Man, they do a number on the Giants.
They really
boy,
do.
Oh boy, that game was over fast. Quick, fast, and hurry.
Yeah. Is it just that the offensive line of the Giants is horrible, or are the defensive front that good?
Well, I think they gave the money to the wrong person. So,
okay.
I mean, I'm not going to take nothing away from Dallas. Dallas is a very talented team. I think now, this year, they'll put it all together, and they may go deep into the playoffs. And I know it's only one game, the first game of the season, but man, that team looks explosive. And the other team in the NFC looks explosive. You already know who I'm getting ready to talk about. They went up in Steel City and handled their business.
Oh,
and it's
God.
Like, you know what? They are on a revenge tour. It's like they're trying to get back to the NFC Championship. This week will be a telltale sign if they'll go back or not.
Who
so,
they play?
That being said, I'm going to get into this week's picks.
All right.
And as you said, like I said, Philadelphia took care of Minnesota on Thursday night. Okay. I never believed in Minnesota anyway. I thought they were a fluke team last year. Now they're 0-2 because they let the pastry chef come up into Minnesota last week and beat them. So Minnesota and Philadelphia over the Vikings was Thursday night. Man, talking about today, about the 1 o'clock slate. I like Green Bay over Atlanta. I'm not convinced about the Dirty Birds. Jordan, it looks like the baton's been passed to Jordan Love for Green Bay.
Okay.
So I like Green Bay going into the ATL and beating the Falcons. Got the Raiders over Buffalo. Buffalo, man, oh man. Boy, did they get embarrassed. They looked horrible. Four turnovers. All of them that kept the Jets in the game and for them to win last week. So I look for Buffalo to bounce back. I think they might dial down the offense just a little bit. I think Josh Allen's trying to do too much. So you got the Raiders with porn star Jimmy G at the helm coming in to Buffalo with the Raiders from Vegas. But I just don't feel them right now, so I'm going to take Buffalo. I think Buffalo needs a bounce back game. Same goes with the next game, and I know I really should save this one for the last game for the 1 o'clock slate, but I'm going to get into it right now. I'm talking about your Ravens, who I really wasn't impressed with last week.
Right.
Even that or Texans are a better team than everybody thinks that they are, but they should have mopped they should just went up and down the field and just blew the Texans out. Did they win the game? Yes, they did. Impressively, just like with the Eagles, I was not impressed with the Ravens. They go into Cincinnati to see their rival, Cincinnati, team that took a beating from the crusty Browns. And, you know, I think that that's going to be a bounce back game for them. That's a tough rivalry game. It's going to maybe have some playoff implications down the line in the future. I like Cincinnati to come back horrible performance to beat the Ravens.
And this is not
because I don't like the Ravens. I'm just saying when these two teams play, they usually split. Ravens win here in Baltimore, when they're in Baltimore. Cincinnati usually wins in Cincinnati. So I'm looking for Cincinnati to take the first game of this two-game series.
Nah.
Next up, you got those Sea Chickens. Oh, man, I thought that they were going to do something last week. They let the Rams come in there and just embarrass them on their home field.
Yeah.
They travel to see those pesky Lions.
Oh.
In Detroit.
Who you got?
Yeah. I like Detroit. I'm sorry. That team, man... They're going to surprise a lot of people this year. They really are.
They already have. Defense, yeah.
You know, for them to do what they did against Kansas City on a big game, and this will be their home opener, I'm telling you, Detroit, that season's going to be rocking. I think they have a football team again. So I like the pesky Lions over the Seahawks.
Okay.
And so another team that lost at home, who should have won, and I'm thinking about the Chargers, but the Chargers are such an iffy team. They travel to Tennessee to play the Titans. That's a tough one for me, only because the Titans are at home. I like them better than I like the Chargers.
Okay.
I think it's going to be a close one, but I like the Titans over the Chargers. Next, we have the most disappointing team, in my opinion, for week one would be the Chicago Bears to me. And they travel to see the pastry chef who's at the helm there at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I was quite surprised with the Buccaneers last week, and I'm looking for them to – I don't know what's going with the Bears. I don't know if Justin Fields is taking a step back, if it's the coaching staff. I really can't put my finger on it,
right.
But I do not think they can go into Tampa and beat the Bucs. So I like Tampa Bay over Chicago.
Okay.
Next, here's a nice game. It's a big game. We're talking about the teacher going up against the student going up against the master. And I'm talking about Doug Peterson's Jacksonville Jaguars will host the Kansas City Chiefs, Andy Reid.
Okay.
If you remember when Andy Reid was a coach with the Eagles, Doug Peterson was his quarterback at one time.
Right.
He was on his coaching tree. You know, so that's a tough one. I like both of these teams. I really like Jacksonville, but I think Kansas City is not going to go 0-2, so I like the Chiefs over the Jaguars in Jacksonville. Next up, this game's probably going to be a stinker. I don't like how it looks on the schedule. I don't like neither one of these teams, per se, especially the one that with that horseshoe on their helmet. I'm talking about the Indianapolis Colts. They will go to visit the Houston Texans. Now, Houston didn't look too bad in Baltimore last week. So, you know what? I think Indianapolis is a more talented team, but I like Houston at home over the Colts.
Are you still hating on the Colts for leaving?
I will always hate on the Colts for leaving, but not as much as I hate Dallas.
Okay.
So, make them 1-2. Next up, we got the 4 o'clock games, and I'm going to start with the Giants, who were highly embarrassed, getting their butts kicked all over the Meadowlands last week. They go into Arizona to face those Redbirds, who people who say are tanking. Tanking in football. Can you imagine? They want the number one pick. Well, you know what? I'm looking for the Giants because they were so embarrassed to go into Arizona, into the desert, and handle those Redbirds. I like the Giants over the Cardinals.
Okay.
Next up, this one would have been let me tell you something, Brother B. When this game was on the schedule, before the game was played, they had the point spread line for a couple of games. Well, they had Dallas and this team, Dallas, -3.5 because they were at home. And usually when you're at home and your teams are pretty much even, you get that 3 points. Well, Dallas was going to be giving up 3 points to the J-E-T-S, Jets. And guess what? The line has moved up to 10 points because there will be no Aaron Rodgers. So look at Dallas, you know, to ground the Jets at home.
Okay.
I like the Cowboys over the Jets. This man, is he going to cook or what? What is going on? Is he done? And I'm talking about Russell Wilson and the Denver Broncos. They host the Commanders, who just barely pulled out that game last week against the Cardinals. I really think that the Commanders need to try to find a quarterback. I am not convinced with Sam Howell.
Really?
I don't like that look. I don't like that look that the Commanders are showing with him at quarterback. I highly disagree. I highly doubt that they can go into Denver and beat the Broncos. Russell Wilson's going to have to show him something.
The word is that the Commanders are courting RG3 again.
Well, I don't know why, because he's done. He's been out of this league for a couple of years. So, but they need to find a quarterback, and I do not expect them to go into Denver and beat the Broncos. So give me the Broncos over the Commanders.
Okay.
Miami will go into New England, and I liked how New England looked last week against the Patriots. Against the Eagles. But you know what? For some odd reason, when these two teams play, Miami has their number, usually down in South Beach. But I think Miami's a more talented team than the Patriots, and I think they can go into New Orleans, go into New England and beat the Patriots. I like the Dolphins over the Patriots. And finally, when 4 o'clock's late, this is going to be a good one because the Rams are looking pretty good. They went into Seattle, beat Seattle. They play another division rival today, and I'm talking about they play the 49ers. Now, this is a big for the Rams because if they beat the 49ers, they will have two games up in the division. They will be 2-0 in that division. But you know what, Brother B? It seems like the 49ers have their number. They've won 8 straight regular season games against them. Their only loss coming in the NFC Championship game. So, you know, will it be number 9? I don't know. I think the 49ers may have had a good run beating the Rams in regular season. But you know what? I want to take the Rams so bad. I really do, because I think the Rams are a better team right now, even though the 49ers look good. So the Rams are going to Seattle to win. I like the Rams. But you know what, Brother B? I know I said I like the Rams to win this game, but I'm picking those 49ers. That place would be so many 49er fans down in LA.
I was going to say, bro. You're going to shock me.
You know what? It's going to be like SoFi South, because so many 49er fans will be there. Look, that's going to be a good game. It really is. You got two good teams, and I'm looking for 49ers to make it number 9 over the Rams. Give me the Niners over the Rams. Monday night, there will be two games. Tomorrow night, two games. You have your choice between the Saints and the Panthers or the Browns and the Steelers. Okay. Let's talk about the first one. Saints, Panthers, and Carolina. New quarterback, he didn't look too bad. And that, you know, when they played the Falcons, talking about the Panthers.
Right.
But it's just something about Derek Carr looks like he's a good fit for the Saints. So I like the Saints going into Carolina and beating those Black Cats. Give me the Saints over the Panthers. And finally, those crusty Browns that has a freaking elf in the middle of their field go up against the Pittsburgh Steelers, who were highly embarrassed in Steel City last week.
Yeah,
that's a big game. It's a rivalry that goes way, way back. I don't know how everybody or anybody feels about Kenny Two Gloves Pickett. He looked horrible last week. I'm just surprised that Mike Tomlin had their team looking as bad as they did. And they just didn't seem prepared. 49ers came in there and just destroyed them. But you know what? This is a big rivalry. I can't see Steel City losing to the Browns at home. So give me the Steelers over the Browns. That's what I have, Brother B. And one last thing. What is going on with those high-flying O's? It looks like they're getting their wings clipped. They have been on the end of losing several games. Oh, my goodness. And now they don't have that lead over the Rays at the head. Basically, you know what? It's going to be a battle down to the last week of baseball. I hope, and they will be a playoff team. That's first and foremost. Let's keep that real. I would rather for them to be a division winner. I'm a little disappointed in the play recently. I've always said good things about them. I still believe in them as far as being in the playoffs. I did say they'd be a playoff team. They will be. But I would rather see them in the division. I just hope that they're not going through that slump that a lot of teams go through, because this is not the right time for that.
The worst time to go through it. You're right.
No, you want to go into the end of the year as a powerhouse, as you know, showing a lot of strength. And right now, I just don't see it. Their woes against Tampa continue as far as them playing against them. I hope they don't have to play them in the playoffs. And let's just hope they do good things. There was a poll out about the teams that their percentages of making the playoffs or the World Series, that is, and they were ranked 5th as far as percentage-wise of making the playoffs. And they had Houston and Tampa before the Orioles. And I felt a little...
Disrespectful.
But seeing how they're playing right now, maybe they might be right. Maybe someone sees something that I don't see or other people don't see. I know they got to get it together, man. You want to be playing your best ball going into the playoffs. So let's root for the O's and hope that they don't turn out those other bum birds in Baltimore and let the people down.
Leave my Ravens alone.
On that note, you know what, Brother B? There's one more thing I want to say. It has nothing to do with the sports world, football or baseball. It has something to do with your mayor of Baltimore. Let me tell you something. You tell that chump. I hope he's listening. Come on the show. It's been a year, brother.
I know.
You know what? People got you in the office. They had great expectations. They thought you were going to be doing something nice for the city. You're a young man. They you know, infusing that new blood in there, and you turn out to be a chump, ducking and dodging, saying this and saying that. Come on, brother, come on the show. Yeah, that's right. I called you a chump. Come and find me. Stop hiding up under the rock. Come on the show. Come on the show. Be like the governor. Don't be scared. Come
right.
on the show
right.
and give Brother B some time. Give him some time.
I keep trying, man.
On the air for a year. This is his anniversary show. Everybody's congratulating him. Stop being a chump and give the brother some time. On that note, Brother B, I'm out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother. Peace. I had no idea where he was going with that, but he's absolutely right. This entire year, I've been trying to get Brandon Scott on the show. I know I'll give him grief, but hey, if you're the mayor, come on the show, defend your stance. You know what I mean? But he has not agreed to come on to the show yet. I'm still trying to get him on, and hopefully this year, I'll get him on for one or two episodes. Who knows? Who knows? But listen, the hour has come to an end. It always flies by because I love doing what I do. I love talking to you guys. I love getting feedback from you guys. And I want to mention something. I've had a lot of listeners this year, but the one that stands out the most for me that has supported me even before I got the show when I was just doing news on the April Watch Live show was Sonia Scott Bushrod. She has followed me. She has been a part of my journey from the time I started doing news in the mornings all the way until today. She seems to never miss a show. She always gives me great feedback. And my fan of the year is Sonia Scott Bushrod. And I just want to thank you and your husband so, 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 so much for being a part of my journey and always supporting and encouraging me. And of course, after every show, Sonia is sure to give me feedback, which reminds me, hit me on IG at On With Brian Pettaway. Let me know what you think of the shows, how you feel about the shows. Give me some ideas, some tips. All of the feedback just helps my show grow. It helps me grow. It lets me know what you think, gives me some ideas of what shows I can have. Come on. I've gotten some great ideas from you guys. These ideas are not my own. So please, again, hit me on IG at On With Brian Pettaway. You can leave a message right on the board, or you can hit me privately like a lot of people do. Either way, I get the messages, I read the messages, and they mean a lot to me. So I appreciate you giving me the feedback that you do. And also, of course, I want to thank April Watts. If not for April Watts, I probably wouldn't have the show. She's the one that told me I had to do it. Like, there was no... you had to hear the conversation. She basically called me a punk for not being on the radio and having my own show, right? So, you know, when you challenge me like that, you get what you get. So if not for April, I probably wouldn't be here. So thank you so much, April Watts, for believing me, for pushing me, and for really giving me no choice. You know, speaking of April, you know, she stepped away from 1500 as a personality for about a year just to do bigger and better things in her life to build her brand up more. And it was hard for her to do while she was doing what she was doing for us. But she never lost touch. She never became someone who was not a part of the family, the 1500 family. You know, she did a lot of TV this year. She did a record number of events as far as hosting in the city and around the state. I mean, she was everywhere. She's got billboards all over the city. But she's coming back to 1500 as a radio personality. She's going to be on Monday through Friday from 12 to 2. She's still going to be that midday diva, your original favorite girl. So it'll be nice to have her back. So, you know, please tune into her. She never disappoints. All right, that's my time. I really, really appreciate you guys. I appreciate my staff, the people who have helped me put these shows together, get my guest on the show, edit the show. You know who you are. Love you guys. This has been a blast, and I hope it continues. But you know what time it is. It's Sunday. It's time to do nothing. Sit back, do nothing, relax. But like I always say, and I've been saying for the last year, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. So wake up tomorrow morning, Monday, start the week, conquer the world, have the mentality that nothing's going to stop you. Be upbeat, look half glass full, and just have an amazing week. Love you guys. Gotta go, and thank you for a wonderful year. Peace.